From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, we're talking about a social panic that played out in this country in the 80s and 90s. Panic is what the journalist Alice Talmadge calls it. There were these claims about satanic sexual abuse in childcare centers and families and other places. She's written a book about this period and the false memories that fueled it. It's not an expose, it's a memoir. Her own niece was caught up in the hysteria. Join us after this.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to, and you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You remember in the 80s and early 90s that wave of hysteria about satanic ritual child abuse? There were these fantastic stories about these sinister cults who were supposedly kidnapping children and conducting these dark sexual rituals. And these stories came at the prompting of therapists who urged really vulnerable people to dredge up these repressed memories. Most of that business has been debunked by now. The journalist Alice Talmadge found herself caught up in it when her own young niece, Michelle, a girl who had been afflicted most of her life with mental health issues like depression and bulimia, said that she had recovered her own memories of being forced into these satanic rituals. Michelle committed suicide in 1991. She was only 23. And Talmadge wanted to write a book that helped her explain what had happened. This is a story of how the nationwide panic took hold and how she found herself feeling deeply skeptical but still wanting to believe someone she loved. The book is called Now I Can See the Moon, a story of a social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. Alice Talmadge is a reporter, writer, and editor. She joined us from a studio in Eugene, Oregon. Anytime you talk about issues like this, which involves alleged incidents of child abuse, there are going to be these questions about whether you're in some way diminishing the experience of others by not, you know, believing them. And you deal with this right up front in an author's note in the book, and I wanted to begin with that. You say you don't want to judge or challenge anyone's experience. How are you dealing with that larger question? How are you thinking about that?
Someone asked me if I thought the timing was unfortunate because of the rise of the Me Too movement. And my sense is it's a lot like comparing apples and oranges, in that it's one thing to years later report harassment or abuse that occurred that a person remembers, that told other people about it at the time, and that was done by a person that is recognizable and has a name, and to have those definite parameters around the incident. And it's another thing when you're dealing with stories of abuse where everything is cloudy and hazy. Mm. There's no identifiable person. There's no exact time, and there's no evidence, and there's no corroborating, not witness, but even, you know, the person hadn't told somebody else that this had happened at the time.
Yeah.
So it's, I think, of course, we want to give all the credibility to people who have stories of abuse that happened, and for reasons of their career or the society at the time were unable to come forward with it. But I think that the abuse that was reported during the panic was of a very different nature.
You say you wrote the book to get a fuller understanding of that time. Explain that.
Well, when after Michelle died, there was a long period where I was kind of floating around, not really dealing with what had happened, because I didn't want to. I wasn't ready to. I had no idea what a social panic was. I didn't know that that had happened. And I certainly didn't know that what had happened to my niece had any connection to the daycare trials that had happened in the mid-1980s and also the phenomenon of multiple personality disorder or the recovered memory movement. I didn't know about any of those elements. And so I started researching with satanic ritual abuse piece of it because that was the part I was most familiar with. And then it just got bigger and bigger and more complex. So I dove in.
But you described the book as a memoir. Which is interesting, not an objective analysis.
Correct.
I mean, I have to say, we're going to spend a good deal of time on your exploration of this social panic, but these are, you say that these are what you describe as subjective conclusions. So why a memoir, not a piece of journalism? It, obviously the personal part, but
yes.
Why do you call it a memoir?
I've been a journalist for, what, 3 decades, and I've written, you know, hundreds of features and news stories. And I was familiar with that way of telling a story. This was a story that I felt I was a part of. And I also felt that sometimes the best way to tell a big story is through the experience of one or two people who were, you know, closely involved in that bigger theme, whatever it is. And I did not want to leave out my experience of it, of being a witness to the panic or to the extent to which it affected me, because I wanted to communicate the confusion that I and other people felt during that time, and which I believe probably arises when any social panic gets ignited to that extent.
Yeah.
So it was, I had written first-person essays and I had written journalism, but I had never combined the two. But I felt no one else could tell this story the way that I could because I was both somewhat having a journalistic mind and also was a witness and to some degree a participant.
Yeah.
And I wanted to balance those two perspectives.
It's interesting. I mean, you had your doubts and your skepticism early on, and we'll talk about that. But you also mentioned that there was part of you, because it was so personal and it seemed so real, that you wanted to believe some of these stories. In fact, you describe yourself as straddling two versions of reality.
You know, I came of age in the, or adult age in the mid-70s when the stories of domestic abuse and partner violence were, and incest and in family abuse were just coming to the fore. And those stories were not believed. People could not believe that this kind of thing was happening in families, that was, you know, that kind of abuse was always, certainly the sexual abuse was stranger danger and, you know, it was put away from the family. And I worked in one of the first battered women's shelters in the country in Boston, or volunteered there. And the police, judges, juries, other family members could not believe that the abuse that was reported was going on. So this was a very, you know, profound learning experience for me that, you know, you believe people, even if what they tell you seems inconceivable. So that was kind of my training to give, you give, oh, that's right. We were told, you know, if you disbelieve what somebody, what a battered woman tells you, it's like, you know, re-injuring her all over again because the pain of not being believed just adds to her original abuse. That training went deep in me. And so it was not in my nature to be particularly skeptical. And it was, you know, my niece, and I wanted to give her the benefit of the doubt. Yeah. But at the same time, it was a real stretch to believe the things that she was reporting.
There's a moment when there are a few moments, actually, when I think readers are going to feel the same way I did and say something like, not just to you, but others, as she's telling these stories, all right, Michelle, enough is enough. That is ridiculous. You need to stop this. But it seems it was so much more complicated than just saying something like that.
You know, if there I think, and that was like going back to your other question about why I made it a memoir, is it's so hard to communicate the atmosphere that was going on at the time, because in the mid-80s, nobody was standing up either about the accusations of abuse in daycare centers were just as heinous as the ritual abuse that was being reported. In some cases, they even overlapped. Nobody was coming forward with skepticism. Courts weren't, social workers weren't, the media certainly wasn't. They were all hung up on the sensationalism. So there wasn't even a skeptical narrative to provide another viewpoint. And in my niece's situation, as I write in the book, her mom totally believed her stories, and not her initial therapist, but the ones that she ended up with also believed her. So the power of a cultural mindset supporting an irrational belief, it's hard to communicate, but it existed and in my small piece of the world that I was involved in there. Her beliefs were given a lot of credibility. And in my research, when I later read about false memories, a researcher, her name was Julia Shaw, and she had a couple of great paragraphs where she describes that the part of the brain where the false memories originate, it's not a lie that a person tells themselves, that they really believe in the truth of the false memory. And the more the memory is repeated, the more credibility it has for the person holding it. And these memories are also sensory. So they end up having a lot of power.
One of the things you write about is the difficulty of dealing with this idea of memory. And memories of others, your own memories. In fact, you say the concept of memory is kind of a central theme here in this story and in the book.
It is, and it was a central theme during the panic because of the way I'm sure some of the interviewers didn't even realize that they were cultivating false memories, but because of the lack of understanding about memory and people's vulnerability to developing false memories, the interviewers didn't realize that they were helping to create false memories. And yes, I agree, because my memory was faulty, and thank God I was able to collect letters and journals and medical reports and, you know, have interviews with other people so that my pieces of memory could be either challenged or validated. But yeah, the theme of memory goes all through the book.
Let's talk about Michelle, because she's obviously the vehicle for which you could tell the story. Let's get a setting here first, though. This is in Logan, Utah. This is where your brother John and his wife Mary end up and raise their family. Mary, John's wife, your brother's wife, grew up Mormon. John, your brother, converts to Mormonism, and they end up in a very Mormon place in the Cache Valley area in Logan. The fact that your brother's family were Mormon, how much does religion, not just Mormonism, but in general, how much does that play into and maybe fuel the dynamics of this story? Certainly, Satan was a part of the story. So I'm wondering, how does religion fit into all of that?
Well, it certainly fit into my situation, because as I talk about in the book, when I left Catholicism, which I was very devoted to when I was younger, it left a big hole in me. And I imagine that's the same for anybody who grows up in a strong religious faith and then for whatever reason needs to go and find answers elsewhere. And I also write in the book, it's ironic that I ended up finding shelter in my quest with my brother's family, which was devoutly Mormon and in ways even more strict than Catholicism ever was.
Right.
But they, you know, they did not judge me. They opened their hearts and their house to me and their home to me. But when the situation with Michelle arose, it was difficult because I had really tried to distance myself from the whole concept of Satan and evil and that huge discrepancy between the good and the evil. And I think in the Mormon tradition, it was more circumscribed than I was feeling. Mm. And Utah, it seemed, was particularly vulnerable to the ritual abuse narrative of the panic. And I think probably, that could be because of that real separation between the good and the bad. And I was a real champion of, you know, the gray area, that there's, you know, both, and you have to work with both and not push the evil away because it ends up popping up in unforeseen places. Yeah. So we didn't ever, my brother and his wife and myself, we didn't fight about religion at all. We didn't discuss it, that we were very respectful of each other's views. But it did play a part, and that was part of my resistance because I didn't want to believe the satanic evil was going on. So it was a channel. It's like, no, I've moved away from that. And then the self-questioning was, well, are you trying to ignore something that's very real just because you don't want it to be there? So there was just a lot of, you know, self-questioning that I went through.
You went to live with your brother in Logan. This was in 1975. How do you describe your relationship with Michelle? I mean, you say your time together when you were there with her, you began to, as you put it, discover each other. I mean, she was this social outsider, suffered mm-hmm. from bulimia and anxiety and depression, and she was isolated at times. But you also had a sense of feeling like an outlier yourself, and in some way you connected on that level, it seems.
Yes. Her sister had more of a clear goals and passions and interests that absorbed her, and her younger brother was, you know, more social and had his group of friends, and Michelle just had trouble with relationships. And so when I went to visit, I hung around the house and with Mary, because John was in and out all the time. And so Michelle would be there with us. And like I describe in the book, you spend that much time with each other and you start realizing that you share some things. And even without talking about it, the feelings of safety and the bond grows. And I thought she was just delightful. I think she was quite precocious.
Yeah. In some of the letters that she wrote to you, she seemed really smart. Kind of smart alecky too, and funny, and had a sense of irony. I mean, she seemed mm-hmm. really clever.
Yeah, maybe one of the reasons she didn't get along with her peers is that she was kind of beyond them in those kinds of awarenesses, but maybe not so good on the social back and forth dialogue of the backyard or the streets.
You take us through her story, in the last, you know, last months of her life. She had been doing well. She was at the state hospital in Provo, had been there for some 8 months, but they mm-hmm. allowed her to come home for Thanksgiving. And in some ways you describe it as, this is going to be a test. We'll see how she does.
Yeah, that's what I was told.
Yeah. But she basically planned her suicide, made her family think everything was fine, then asked to borrow the car to visit a friend. Do you just mind saying what happens to Michelle?
Yeah, she doesn't go to the friend's house. She goes to a grocery store and buys a large bottle of aspirin and then takes the highway up towards Bear Lake into Idaho. And apparently she had tried this before and had made herself sick, so she knew how to measure out the aspirin so that she wouldn't get sick before they started to take effect. And she apparently drove into a snowbank in one of the mountain passes and got out of the car and was wandering along the side of the road. And that's when a man and his wife found her and picked her up and drove her, I believe it was, to Garden City. And she actually stopped breathing when she was with them. And he was able to call 911, and an ambulance came and took her to the border. And the ambulance from Cache Valley met them at the top of the pass and took her back into Logan. And she died in the hospital.
Let's talk about how this kind of descent plays out. You lay it out, obviously, in the book. There's a letter this is in April of 1989, where she mentions she was raped by some boys in Central Park in New York, walking home from a roller skating rink. And you mention your own reaction to that, just wanting to scream. And this would be years before you say you would question the story, but let's talk about that. What's happening with the, like in the initial moment here? Explain how you understand that story that she said then, now.
When I first read the letter, I can remember, you know, sitting in my my little duplex and reading it. And I think it was in April, and it was just at the beginning of spring. And, you know, I had been excited to receive a letter from her. They had always been so, or most often were just charming things to read, and did not expect this at all. And I was just dumbfounded. You know, it's funny when you, this had happened years earlier, but it didn't matter to me. Just having heard about it, time was kind of erased, and it was like it had happened, you know, the week before. And of course, I felt protective and outraged and just, you know, very upset. And like, oh, well, maybe this is why she became so bulimic. Maybe this was why she had trouble relating people. But that was more of a intellectual reaction. My first reaction was much more primal and just, God, you know, fury and sadness.
Let's talk about the time when this idea of a satanic cult becomes part of the story. You say when she first mentions the cult, that, you know, the Satan part, it was as if, this is how you put it in the book, it was as if she had begun speaking in an alien dialect, and you felt like you had to kind of slow her down. Tell that story, if you would.
Yeah, well, that happened just a few months after I got the letter, and a large segment of my family were meeting in Cincinnati for the wedding of another one of my nieces. And we went for a walk the morning of the wedding, and I want to backtrack. When I saw John at the motel, I said, you know, Michelle told me about the rape. I'm so sorry. And he didn't really respond. He just kind of looked beyond me and said, you know, well, have you talked to her yet? And I said, no. And he goes, you know, well, try to, please. And that's all he said. And I didn't really think that much of his response. But Michelle and I went for a walk the next morning. And as I describe the conversation in the book, that's when she told me that she had started having flashbacks of this abuse by Satanists that had apparently happened throughout her childhood. And I was just dumbfounded. Number one, I had never heard of such a thing to begin with, but then to have her tell it was dumbfounding. And then knowing the layout of their house and how impossible it was for anybody to, you know, go in there without everybody knowing about it. So it, you know, it didn't make rational sense, but emotionally she was so matter of fact and convinced of it. It was just, like two worlds colliding, as it would feel like for the next, you know, couple of years.
How do you explain the nature of these flashbacks? Not only Michelle's, but then the dozens that are emerging during this time. You describe them as brief, terrifying images of bloody sacrifices and tortured animals and depraved sexual acts. There was even a moment toward the end when Michelle talks about how this cult group got her pregnant, and she somehow was able to conceal it and then give birth to the baby, and then they made her kill it in some ritual way. How do you explain all of that? And were these typical kinds of stories in this social panic, that they all had these elements, and did they feed on each other? I mean, how do you understand it?
That's how I understand it now. Yes, I believe they were typical. They did feed on each other. And that one book that I talk about, Michelle Remembers, that was supposedly a young woman's memories of satanic abuse. And she was the woman from British Columbia. She and her husband, well, he was her therapist, and they later married. And supposedly the book was transcriptions of their sessions that they had had. And a lot of people now say that that's kind of like a template. They fed off of the template of the stories that were told in that book. Now, I can't remember if she said that she had given birth to a child and been made to ingest it, but I definitely came across those same stories from other people who were reporting this kind of abuse. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's how social panics work. And in some of my research, the whole idea of giving birth to infants and ingesting them, it's very old. It like goes back centuries. It's not an unheard of. It's like the most grotesque fear or paranoia that somebody could think of. It's that kind of fear that gets energized or awakened at times of a social panic. And people, it just seems confounding now, but in the time of the social panic, people take that as not only possible, but probable.
Yeah.
It's a very, the mindset that's created in a social panic is kind of very hard to accept as possible when we're in another reality. Mm. But it swept up a lot of people.
You write about the history of this, how in ancient Rome, Christians were accused of kidnapping Roman children for sacrifices, how the Greeks
yeah.
accused the Jews of kidnapping their children for sacrifices. So I get that ancient part of it, how this goes back. But how does that fit in the 1980s? What's the connection there, do you think?
Well, this is where I get totally subjective, but I've come to think of a social panic as being almost like a virus that lies dormant for centuries. And when a certain combination of social factors come together, the virus erupts and it causes all sorts of chaos and then it goes away. And I think there are probably, you know, purists who would have objections to that analogy, but that's how it seemed to me. When you read about the Salem witchcraft trials, Schiff, her last name is, wrote a book called The Witches. There are paragraphs that you could lift out of that book and apply to the 1980s because it was the same kind of hysteria mindset that people just kind of got infected with and passed to each other. And they just kind of swam in that mindset and were engulfed in it. And we want to believe that we're immune to this, but I think that what the social panic made me aware of is that we're not. Mm. This core of whatever it is, this really instinctual thing that we have inside of us, and I think it's collective, and is where paranoia takes precedence over rational thinking, fear, rumor, where we let ourselves get behind that kind of thinking rather than fairness and justice and rational thinking. We're not prone to it, but we can be vulnerable to it in certain circumstances. And that's what I came to believe after writing this or during writing this.
So you have this kind of baseline narrative that there's something evil going on, and then you have conservative political figures and conservative religious institutions that give a kind of momentum to it. You write about that. But then you write about how this isn't all that was happening. You mentioned that plenty of secular authorities also signed on to the moral panic. You know, you had law enforcement and social work and psychiatry. And you also say the hysteria attracted feminist and pro-female advocates, too. So there's plenty of blame to go around, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And I didn't want to point the finger at Mormonism, definitely, or any particular religion or any, you know, socioeconomic group, because where it hit, the communities that were affected by the daycare cases, communities that were affected by ritual abuse reports, the false memories, they were all over the map. They were all over the place, and they affected, you know, the whole stratum of our culture.
You tell this story of one night when Michelle's mother, Mary, went and got some of her yearbooks, her daughter's yearbooks, and asked her to, hey, look, identify the boys who were involved.
Yeah.
John and Mary actually reported a rape to the police. John, there were a couple of times he actually confronted the fathers of two of the boys that Michelle had identified. Later he went back and confronted or tried to confront some of the people that Michelle said were part of this cult or leading this cult. I mean, they were taking this seriously, and it made you sort of realize just how destructive something like this could be. And then you mentioned how your brother John said to you at some point, it's just a matter of time before she includes me in all of this. And then there's this moment when Michelle said to you, she knew her parents were at these satanic rituals, that she had seen them, they tried to help, but they couldn't.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty scary.
Yep. And that's where the whole false memory thing comes in, because, you know, I think the last couple who were caught up in the child care abuse charges, Fran and Dan Keller, I believe, in Austin, Texas, they were just officially exonerated last year.
Yeah.
Each of them spent 19 or 20 years in prison. They hadn't done anything. But that's how powerful this narrative was, that as far as being able to destroy lives. And we don't hear about the lives destroyed. We heard about the sensationalism of the charges. You know, I think John was a little bit, he had a rational mind. He could see where this was going. And so when he said that, I don't think he knew about the false memories and how they were affecting families, and people were, you know, predominantly young women coming forward with claims of abuse by family members that were questionable. And here we get on dicey ground, because in family abuse does happen.
Sure.
And some of those things were true. So I do not want to minimize that at all. But in a certain realm of therapeutic processes, some false memories were cultivated, and the people got charged.
Yeah, you're right about one of the critical elements of this particular a twist in the story was that to heal from the effects of these, you know, these repressed memories, you needed to recall the experience with the help of a therapist.
Yeah.
And this is when you say this recovery, you know, recovered memory movement had some fundamental misconceptions about the mechanisms of memory. And I wanted to ask you about that. It just the idea of how vulnerable to suggestion, how vulnerable to change the memory could be. Say something about that, if you would.
Well, I think at the time, people, and I'm not even trying to say that now we have an absolute clear understanding of how memory works, but we had even less of one back then.
Right.
And I think that there was not enough of an appreciation of how the dynamic of the interview process, whether it be an investigator, a police investigator, or a social worker, or a therapist, how their mode of interviewing someone could be affected by the power differential, by the whether it be the child from a daycare center or a client who came into to therapy for depression or other issues, how vulnerable that our minds can be under certain circumstances to accepting a false memory or having one be created, and then we repeat it enough times and it becomes truth to us.
Mm. I think it's interesting the way you write about contemplating, should I research this? Should I write about this? What should I do about this? And you mentioned how you You wanted to go to the library and try to get some insight about all of this, but at first you couldn't bring yourself to do it. Why not? What was keeping you from that initially?
Can I just read you this paragraph that I kind of typed out? Because this is kind of sums up how I felt. It's from the book.
And
it's,
sure.
It's an uncomfortable feeling when something you think you have no part of, want no part of, knocks at your door and insists you let it in, suggests even that you share some history. Its clothes are stained. It has bad breath. Its voice is harsh and whiny. Your first inclination is to push it away, deny any kinship, and send it packing. That's how it was when I found myself having to deal with the phenomenon of satanic ritual abuse. The phrase repelled me. I wanted not to have to know about it. I wanted to lock the door and pretend I had never heard the knocking. But it kept coming back. The knocking became louder and more insistent. I finally realized I had to invite it in and hear what it had to say, no matter how ludicrous, how unthinkable. Mm. So in order to come to terms with Michelle's death, I needed to understand what happened to her in my own mind.
Yeah.
And so that's what propelled me. But I had a lot of resistance to doing it.
You also write about how the this is how you put it in the book, the real tormentor, as you saw it, was what you describe as people's unquestioning belief in the existence of this massive cult, despite the absence of any demonstrable proof.
Yeah.
And then you also wondered just how that panic was affecting you, in the sense that it made you, at least you worried, is this making me less willing to speak out? I mean, it seemed like there was a lot of powerful forces at play during the time for people who may have wanted to express skepticism, may have wanted to say, no, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just really powerful, the dynamic of a moral panic, a social panic.
Yeah. I know Debbie Nathan, she was like one of the first ones to come out in like 1987. And her first skepticism was about a daycare charge against a woman in New Jersey. And she was vilified for coming out to support this woman because even amongst other journalists, the things that these daycare workers were purported to have done were so heinous, so beyond the pale, that how could anybody think that they were innocent? For me, it created a very powerful and cultural environment. And it was, you know, back home in Oregon, people weren't thinking that same way. They didn't have the close relationship with it that I did. And so I could see that it wasn't the same there, but in Logan, it was the atmosphere of the social panic was just so thick. And I, for a time, gave it credibility, I have to say. There was a time when I was like, well, maybe this did happen. Maybe these people do exist. I mean, I occupied that ground for, a short period of time, but it was very tumultuous mentally and emotionally.
Alice Talmadge, her book is Now I Can See the Moon, a story of a social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West, so thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Alice Talmadge. We're talking about her book, Now I Can See the Moon, a story of a social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. Let's talk about when you last saw Michelle. You visited her in Provo at the state hospital. This was August of 1991. Talk a little bit about what she was like at the time. One of the things she said to you was, the cult knows I'm here.
Yeah. It's still a hard memory to talk about. It was lovely because she wasn't expecting to see me, and she was so clearly delighted when she looked up and there I was. And she was, very thin at the time. I never saw her in the throes of any of her freakouts or her recovered memories or her flashbacks. Except for a little bit early on when I went to visit the family and she had was bulimic. We usually met on a, I don't know, I was able to find the person that I always knew to be Michelle to connect with, and that's who I was able to reach that day at the hospital. But she did, we had this conversation. I told her about her sister's wedding and wedding reception and how lovely it was. And, we just shared some chit chat and told her about my new dog and all of that. And then she matter of fact, the cult knows I'm here. And then, and later I found out that the people that she was a therapist at the state hospital, also believed in the cult and had, probably talked with her about it, knowing that it could track all of her movements, always knew where she was, knew what she was saying. I mean, it's like a science fiction belief of giving this evil entity enormous powers and making you a perennial victim, that that you can, once the cult has you, they can reel you in at any time, and you are never really in control of yourself once they have their hooks in you. And I believe that that's what this therapist believed, and I'm sure she shared that with Michelle, who was vulnerable to believing that herself by then.
Of course. At one point during the visit, she said to you, how do you feel inside you? How do you feel yourself? Do you feel like you are just one person? She asked you. Explain that. What was she getting at? What was she trying to understand?
Well, at the time, she believed she had multiple personality disorder, and she felt very, very fragmented. And as I read later that night in her journals, she had herself divided up into, 12, 13, 14 different personalities. She gave them names. She gave them personalities. She felt very divided. And I think that's what she was referring to, whether she had multiple personality disorder or some other mental illness that made her unable to connect with a solid core of identity. I don't know, but I think that's what she was referring to. And I think she felt very fragmented and, out of control of herself.
Well, you write about reading her notebooks after she had died later.
Yeah.
Describing, you say you saw in those notebooks, I mean, they must have been really disturbing for you being so close as you were with her, but you said you saw a mind at war with itself.
Yes. Yeah, they were very graphic and even more so than I was, able to communicate in the book. I mean, it was just, you just saw this mind and this desperate plea for help and wholeness that she was not able to reach.
I want to ask you, so when does the spell break, basically? It took a while. I mean, it did not die out quickly. You talk about there were various articles that made attempts at trying to debunk some of this, the Village Voice and Harper's and David Shaw and the Los Angeles Times and the New Yorker did a remarkable series, I remember.
Lawrence Wright.
Lawrence Wright did. But it took a while. And so how do you identify? You mentioned Malcolm Gladwell's book, A Tipping Point, and you're able to sort of see the moments when this finally dismantles. How do you explain it?
Like any virus, I think once the conditions no longer support it, it, it goes away. And I think one of there was a bunch of different things that happened, and one of them was in those all those child care convictions, child daycare worker convictions started getting overturned one by one because they started realizing about or having more awareness about how the interview process made the witnesses coerce the witnesses into saying things that they didn't. That they didn't necessarily believe to be true. And so it was kind of like things happen in society. It was kind of quiet, but those convictions were overturned. You know, Kenneth Lanning, in his FBI report, he said, wait a minute, I've been investigating this for, I don't know, 7-11 years, however long it was, and we cannot find any evidence of this kind of satanic activity happening. And I think he makes this very profound quote about now it's up to the mental health establishment to figure out why people keep coming up with these reports, because there was the, you know, it was like ration returned, evidence is evidence. There simply wasn't any. I mean, there was one case where they took a earth mover and a bulldozer where some kid had said that, you know, this and this had happened regarding, you know, satanic abuse, and they, you know, excavated like a whole area and found nothing. Just, you know, the scars weren't there. The evidence wasn't there. No names. And after a while, it was like, come on, people, like, let's wake up. And insurance companies, you know, they started realizing that these wings that had been opened up for people with multiple personality disorder who were, you know, who were kind of made more sick through the course of their therapy than they were when they came in. When they stopped going to therapy, they started getting better. And so there were lawsuits, and the insurance companies started paying for these long-term stays. And so those wings started shutting down, and people started suing the therapists and winning. So I think it was just a very slow, like a ship moving, just very, very slow, but in these all different areas of the culture, people getting enough distance or whatever to start being skeptical. But unfortunately, I don't think the waning of the panic did not get the attention that the supposed accusations got when they first appeared. So I got the feedback from one person who read my book. They said, I had no idea that this was ever debunked. I thought it really happened.
But isn't that always the case? The debunking never gets the attention as the sensation of the story. That's kind of a shame.
It is a shame, and there are some people who were so invested. And this is one part that I do not understand even now, is that who are so invested in the ritual abuse narrative that they want it to continue. And that either they made their reputation on it or whatever, but there are people who will who just insist that it's true, despite all of this evidence or lack of evidence, and the research that's gone into it and the naming of it as this social panic. There are people who do not want to let it die.
Do you think we're still pretty vulnerable as a society to a to another kind of moral panic, whatever it might be?
I would say I wish it weren't so, but I think we are. And I wouldn't give it a time frame. I mean, the Salem witchcraft trials, which I think was the closest thing in history to what the 1980s panic was. I think there's other little ones that happened, like Malcolm Gladwell talks about. But I think that was the closest. And that was, what, 300-400 years ago. Yeah. So it could take a long time. If it happens, it'll be a very different it'll look very different because of all the social media that we have and the different voices that are able to chime in and the fact checking. But on the other side of that, rumors can fly faster as well in paranoia. So I think critical thinking and not jumping on bandwagons is so important. And when I used to, I taught journalism for a while, and I would just grill my students because they would want to do a story on some sensational thing that was going on. I said, have you talked to the police? Have you got records? Do you have facts? Back this up.
Yeah.
You can't go on what people think might be happening. We need to know. And I'm more vigilant about that now than I was earlier.
You mentioned John and Mary when Michelle was alive. They never really agreed on how to quite deal with that after she died. There was this gap between them. But how are they now, John and Mary?
I think they're both really good. I think they delight in their grandchildren. They still live in the same house. They're both healthy. I haven't seen Mary in a couple of years. I'll see her soon. John, I just saw recently. His grandkids adore him. Yeah, I think they're doing well. I think they went through a difficult time. Of course, it's always hard when you're writing a memoir. You want to protect the privacy of the people who who are your family members who didn't agree to put themselves out on the page like you, the author, has decided to do. But I think they went through a hard time and came out of it strong.
Alice Talmadge. Her book is Now I Can See the Moon, a story of a social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. She joined us from a studio in Eugene, Oregon. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.